You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Tucked in a small parking lot on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Leimert Park is Josephine and Billy's, a 1920s speakeasy-themed cannabis dispensary. On a Thursday night, this shop is empty. Operating a legal dispensary in California has never been harder than it is right now. That's mostly due to the fact that legal cannabis is wickedly expensive.
So if you're in a neighborhood like ours, your customers are mostly locals. They don't have the disposable income as folks coming from on vacation to Melrose.
Ebony Anderson co-owns this shop, one of thousands of cannabis businesses across California that are struggling to survive in the legal market, which is leading to predictions that many businesses in the legal market will end up shutting down for good. But California generated more than $1 billion in taxes on legal weed last year. So, how can the legal cannabis industry be on the verge of collapse? Reporter Mary Carrion picks up the sticky story from here.
California's Green Rush officially kicked off after Prop 64 legalized recreational cannabis in 2016. And money signs lit up the eyes of hopeful politicians, investors, and people ready to pioneer an industry. Flash forward 5 years, and California's legal market is drowning. Craft cannabis farmers are going out of business. Legal dispensaries rarely turn a profit. And businesses are shuffling debt bubbles up and down the supply chain. This isn't exactly how cannabis legalization was pitched 5 years ago when voters approved Proposition 64.
When you go back and you look at the advocates, what the advocates for Proposition 64 said would happen, and you look at their policy proposals, they clearly overpromised. They clearly chose not to follow best business practices and fundamentals in these promises.
Dr. Keith Taylor is a professor of extension at UC Davis who researches the efficacy of Prop 64. His findings show that the next 2 years are going to be dire for small cannabis businesses unless the state reforms the legal framework ASAP.
The clock is ticking, and I'm not saying that to over-exaggerate. It absolutely is.
There are three central problems created by Prop 64 that have culminated into a perfect storm for legal operators. The first issue is California grew way too much weed. Last summer, the wholesale price of a pound of outdoor cannabis dropped from around $1,200 to $300 due to a massive oversupply in the market.
We were always prepared for the price to drop, but nothing like this. It has been very challenging since last summer, you know, for our farm. At the same time,
Autumn Shelton is the president of the Cannabis Association for Responsible Producers, an industry association made up of greenhouse cultivators on the Central Coast. The current glut in the market is the result of the state issuing thousands of cultivation licenses while only administering hundreds of retail permits. That means there aren't enough legal dispensaries in the state to sell the amount of product grown by cultivators.
It's too many municipalities aren't allowing or providing such a difficult pathway to be able to get licensed and get permitted that we have too many cultivators compared to the retailers.
And last summer's price crash has been greatly exacerbated by Prop 64's tax regime, which is the second issue at play. It costs roughly $150 to harvest a pound of cannabis flower. But when you tack on a flat state cultivation tax of $161 per pound on top of local cultivation taxes, the wholesale value of cannabis becomes less than the cost to grow and process it. Anderson says the price drop plus this cultivation tax creates debt before the plant is even harvested.
When you're producing a pound at a few hundred dollars and you have state taxes at over $160 per pound, you're looking at a net loss every time. And so as that debt gets passed on from the small farmer all the way down to retail, we're all kind of taking a hit.
For perspective, no other agricultural product is taxed at cultivation, but legal pot farms are required to pay a cultivation tax that's applied to each pound that's sold. Moreover, no other retail models are required to pay excise, state, and local business taxes at the rates dispensaries are either. Taylor from UC Davis says the taxation of cannabis is unlike any other tax model.
It's an irrational tax system that does not follow standard ag or retail tax laws.
A flat cultivation tax is levied at the top of the supply chain. Every tax that follows is layered on the previous tax as a product makes its way up the supply chain and into dispensaries. All of these taxes are passed on to the consumer, who is then expected to pay $75 for an eighth of cannabis. That leads to the third critical problem. There's a massive parallel illegal market for weed where operators aren't paying any taxes, so their products are infinitely cheaper, like around $30 versus at $75. Jared Kylo, the owner of Higher Path Dispensary on Ventura Boulevard, says he can't fault anyone for buying the less expensive option.
If someone told me my car was 50% cheaper, you think I'm going to buy it from the Toyota dealership? I'm going to go where it's 50% cheaper. It's the same car, right?
As a result, California's illegal weed market is more than twice the size of the legal industry. There are a number of financial barriers to entry that also deter people from joining the regulated market, such as the cost of licensure and bringing a state-compliant business to market. So why become a legal business?
There isn't a lot of incentive, I think, especially seeing what's happening to us right now. I think the government is doing a terrible job of showing what the model looks like because the model is struggling.
Legal operators haven't been shy about letting state regulators know there's a problem. Emerald Triangle Growers from Northern California held a rally at the Capitol steps, and some industry groups threatened a tax strike, while dispensary owner Jared Kylo and the United Cannabis Business Association endorsed a letter to Governor Newsom that essentially said,
"Everywhere in the supply chain we talked, none of us are making money. That's unsustainable. And not only are we not making money, we are now losing money at a rate that we cannot afford in business."
The letter demanded three things: the elimination of the state's flat cultivation tax, a three-year hiatus from the state's excise tax, and the expansion of retail access. Governor Newsom said in his 2022-2023 annual budget speech a few weeks later that he was supportive of cannabis tax reform, but didn't reveal other details. Now there are four bills in the legislature to reform the tax regime, but no relief has been granted yet.
Gavin Newsom is very intellectual about this industry. He helped form it coming from San Francisco. He was a champion for cannabis, champion for patients, but it's not his job to wave a magic wand and take away all the taxes. It's not his job, and it's not something we should expect him to do. So the legislator is the body that should be taking on tax reduction. No governor should just give tax reduction to any industry arbitrarily because they say they need it, because every industry says they need less taxes.
While the state drags its feet, cities like Desert Hot Springs and San Francisco have been lowering local cultivation taxes over the past few years. Here in Southern California, Long Beach Mayor Robert Garcia lowered the distribution tax from 6% to 1% and confirmed that his city is in discussions about reducing its cultivation tax.
Still, we want to make sure, obviously, that we're making enough revenue that we're actually paying for the services. I mean, the city is providing also a lot of services, a lot of staff, just focus on cannabis.
California is known for its cannabis the way it's also known for its wine. Many in the industry believe Prop 64 could permanently damage that cultural legacy if careful action isn't taken at the state level immediately.
Everyone is leaving the state. Our growers of 25 years, the chemists, the salespeople, the people who are connoisseurs, they're leaving the state for profit opportunities somewhere else. And when you drain the state of its intellectual property and just the people who are the most like experienced, you have to look and go, why are we decimating an industry when we've got $15 billion of possible revenue here?
Those billions of dollars are being wasted, Kylo says, unless the state fixes this sticky situation. For KCRW, I'm Mary Carrion.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Oil Can Harry's was an LGBTQ dance nightclub and bar in Studio City for more than half a century. The watering hole survived an LA ban on same-sex couples dancing. That definitely was a thing. The HIV/AIDS epidemic, even a 2019 Grammy after party with everyone from Lady Gaga to Lizzo. But once the pandemic hit, the long-standing iconic bar struggled. In 2021, then-owner John Fagan announced the building had been sold and they were closing their doors. Well, now L.A. may designate that site as an historic cultural monument. Here to tell us more about the history and the legacy is Philip Zunkel. He's a journalist and publisher of Q Voice News. And Rick Dominguez was a DJ at Oil Can Harry's for 28 years. Welcome to you both.
Hey.
Thanks for having me.
Philip, I'll start with you. For folks who never went, tell us about Oil Cans. I mean, it was the oldest gay bar, or one of the oldest gay bars in L.A., right?
Yeah, Oil Can Harry's opened in 1968, and it was the longest continuing operating gay club in the Los Angeles area. And like you mentioned in the intro, it survived, you know, the HIV pandemic. It survived various discrimination against members of the LGBTQ community when they couldn't dance together. There actually was an ordinance the city of LA passed saying that same-sex couples could not dance together. It really was kind of launched at, in some ways, what's considered the dawn of the civil rights movement in the late 1960s into the early 1970s. And it really was this kind of, you know, safe space for people in the, you know, LGBTQ community, where they could go and be themselves, they could meet friends, hang out with friends, kind of was a sanctuary of sorts. And it lasted like that until 2020.
Rick, when did you start working there?
I started in the early 90s. I want to say like 1993, 94, somewhere around there.
Wow. And what made you go there? Was it, I mean, had you gone there before you became a DJ? Was it one of the, you know, it was like, oh, gosh, I want to work here one day.
Well, yeah, it started as they dragged me there for a Sunday show called The Campers. The Campers were like a drag kind of camp show. And I had never been there. I didn't know what it was. And I went. And I literally fell in love with the place on my first night. I was like, wow, this place is amazing. And then I was told they do country line dancing on Fridays, or I don't remember what night it was. And I was like, well, let's come back for that night. So we went back. And I went out there and I saw what they were doing. And I said, I can do this. I learned some dances. And somehow I just ended up falling in love with that space and returning every week. I became a regular. I got to know all the staff. I got to know a lot of the really sweet, beautiful people there. And next thing you know, and I had already been a DJ, you know, since I moved to California. So I started way back in the mid 80s, and country started growing on me, you know, the not just the dancing, but the music. So I opened up my own little night at a different club I was working at. We started a country night. So I started kind of establishing myself in that sense, and then becoming friends with the instructors and the DJs at Oil Cans. I kind of weaseled my way in and became like a sub DJ, a sub, you know, instructor when they didn't have somebody. And then, yeah, by mid 90s, I was in.
Obviously, there was the line dancing night at Oil Cans, but there was also disco night. There were so many genres of music, right, that you played, Rick.
Yes, I did the disco night for 20 years. We actually started that night.
Yeah. So
I remember, yeah, we brought out like all these mannequins dressed as Donna Summer and Diana Ross and Cher, and record, like the old record covers. We would make little montages and post them all over the bar. And it was a great night. Saturday disco nights was epic.
So, Philip, the LA City Council is going to vote on giving it historic designation. Why now? And who's behind this?
Well, Paul Krikorian, who's the councilman in that particular district, he put the motion up, he introduced it to be considered for historic designation, or to get the application moving. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that if we don't do it now, the sooner you do it, the better, right? Because there's always the chance or the possibility of someone may sell it, we might want to do various changes, construction, may want to even tear it down. And with the cultural and historic monument designation, it puts the brakes on any sort of changes that somebody would, or modifications or construction somebody would want to do to the structure. And it's a great way to preserve that history and have it kind of live on for years and years. Yes, the club is gone, but that building is there, and that just holds so much memories, so much significance for us. you know, it's not so much what the architecture of the building looks like, because a lot of people think, talking about historic monument designation, it has to be this, you know, fantastic Art Deco or ornate type building, which some buildings are.
That wasn't Oil Can Harry's.
That was not Oil Can Harry's. And nothing against Oil Can Harry's for that, yeah. But that definitely was not it. But what's important for these LGBTQ spaces is the cultural significance, which means what happened inside these spaces. They became safe spaces. They became meeting spaces. They became, in some ways, maybe gatherings for political events to help further LGBTQ issues. And, you know, when you lose your history, you begin to lose a part of your identity. And if Oil Can Harry's gets that designation, it'll be the third LGBTQ space/structure in the entire Los Angeles area that has that designation. So, you know, three is great, but it would be great if we had a lot more.
I guess before I let you guys go, I have to ask the question, does this designation mean that Oil Can Harry's can be saved, or that it'll move on in another iteration, maybe somewhere else? Does anyone have any insight on that? Because I think people want to know.
God, I hope so. there is talk. There is people that have been calling me in the past few months that are interested in now becoming investors in a space. And that's just on my end. And I'm trying to get together this information to move forward on that with a space. So that would be amazing if we could do that. I'm trying to save at least our community, the country community. I do a monthly dance right now for us called Follow Your Arrow, which it's actually happening this Friday at the Mayflower Club here in North Hollywood. And it's, you know, a huge, we have a huge turnout for all of our, you know, Oil Can's family comes, and it makes them feel like they're back at home, so to speak. So right now, that's what I've got going as far as helping, you know, the Oil Can's community stick together until we do find a permanent home, which, well, it's going to happen, I'm sure.
I want to thank you both for coming on and talking about it. DJ Rick Dominguez, former employee over at Oil Can Harry's for decades. Philip Zonkel, journalist and publisher of Q Voice News. Thanks to you both.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
Onward now with Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The world is a complicated place these days, but thankfully there are simple pleasures, like baseball, which recently concluded a 99-day labor lockout regarding competitive balance taxes and minimum salary adjustments. Like I said, simple pleasures. The LA Angels begin their season tonight at the Big A in Anaheim against the pennant-winning Houston Astros, minus their trash cans. The Dodgers start on the road tomorrow in Denver against the Colorado Rockies. And joining us to talk about the season ahead is our old friend Petros Papadakis, who co-hosts the Petros and Money Show on AM 570 LA Sports KLAC. Yasu, Petros.
Yasu day, and happy spring, and baseball is here, and it's very exciting for people in the city, as we are a baseball town primarily with the Dodgers.
Yeah, well, let's start with the Dodgers. They came up short last year, losing in the championship series to the Braves, who then went on to win the World Series. This year, similar expectations. Seems like the Dodgers had the most to lose if baseball did not happen this year to the lockout, right?
Yeah, well, as far as money goes, too, because Dodgers are the most visited sport, as we've talked about before, Steve, on Earth. Now, as far as the team being good, like you mentioned, they spend a lot of money, and they make a lot of money, and their expectations are to compete for the World Series every single year. And that hasn't really been any different since this group took over. Not a family that owns the Dodgers anymore, like that owns the Lakers, the Buss family, or that used to own the Dodgers, like the O'Malley family. Now it's a financial group, which is a lot more common these days, the Guggenheim group. And they make sure that there's a quality product out there every single year.
Manager Dave Roberts predicted a World Series win this year on the Dan Patrick Show. But aside from, you know,
a little odd. It was an odd moment. You know, I think Dan has this interviewing style where he goes like, we'll win the World Series if, you know, it's a question he asked and you're supposed to fill in the blank as if you're a child in class. And Dave kind of jumped the gun, and he was like, we'll win the World Series. And Dave was like, absolutely, yes, yes, we're going to win. And then he kind of doubled down on it. And then, yeah, because there's so much circumstance involved, even if you have the best lineup in baseball, which is what the Dodgers are trying to boast, I mean, there's so much circumstance involved in anybody's championship at any level actually hoisting the trophy that a lot of media and people have really kind of seized upon it. And I mean, you know about it. And they've been asking Dave about it, or Doc Roberts, or the skipper, or however you want to call him. And he keeps tripling, quadrupling.
Yeah, he's not
like, yes, no,
he's not going back. Yeah, he's not going back. And if he doesn't hoist that trophy, then maybe, you know, he'll deal with it then, I guess.
It will be like that. You're right. People will reference it. Well, the second the Dodgers don't hoist the trophy, if they're eliminated, even if it's in the World Series, you're going to hear that interview
over and over and over again, I'm sure. Let's talk about some roster changes for both LA teams. Again, we're talking about the Dodgers. We'll get to the Angels in just a second. Who's new and who's left?
Max Scherzer, who was there very briefly and then like had body fatigue or something at the end of the season, is gone. Clayton Kershaw's healthy and had a great spring, which a lot of people didn't expect because he was injured. Walker Buehler is going to be the opening day pitcher. Julio Urias is still around. And then let's
Freddie
see what
Freeman.
Else.
You can't forget
Freddie Freeman at first base. Yeah, from Villa Park. Freddie Freeman, they signed him. So that was a huge thing. And then Max Muncy is back. He's not hurt anymore. So it's still a pretty recognizable team, but you kind of don't have the wild card type of guys like Jock Peterson and Yasiel Puig anymore.
Let's talk about the Angels, who added their pitcher Noah Syndergaard, right, from the Mets?
Yeah, Thor.
Thor. but for the Angels, who, by the way, starts tonight over at the Big A, it's about their stars like Ohtani and Mike Trout staying healthy.
Yeah, and they you know, it takes more than those two guys, obviously, for the Angels to have success. And that's kind of been the problem over the years, is kind of the supporting cast. But Rendon, who was a big acquisition and was hurt most of last year, is going to be back. And they have a lot of hope. They have a lot more optimism this year under that manager, Joe Maddon, than a lot of people. And a lot of people think, I think Manassian is his name, the GM of the Angels. A lot of people think he had a spectacular offseason with the team he put together.
Did the lockout hurt anything, Petros, do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, I think to most people, it's just noise, right? And I think anybody who has a job, whether you're a plumber or an air traffic controller or whatever, I mean, you understand what a collective bargaining agreement is. It's not always for this high of stakes where people care. I think if they cut into their season significantly, especially with the COVID fatigue and the fatigue of, you know, a lot of the different things that we've been publicly dragged through. I mean, do you really want to hear players argue about, you know, this many millions of dollars as opposed to this many millions of dollars?
Yeah.
It's a turnoff. Yeah. I mean, it really is a turnoff. But I think for people that were really like dug in and involved in it, it got a little frustrating back and forth. But to baseball fans, realizing there's going to be the full allotment of games at Dodger Stadium that they can take their family to, that's all they really care about.
Petros Papadakis, the Greek half of the Petros and Money Show on AM 570 Sports KLAC. Petros, Yasu, thank you.
Yasu, enjoy the baseball season. And whether the teams are good or not, you know, it's always great to be with the people you love out at the ballpark.
Amen to that. Play ball. Well, that's it for us this evening. Next week, with self-checkout, in some cases no checkout at all, what's the future of grocery stores and grocery workers? That's next week. And use of the party drug ketamine for mental health treatment is booming in upscale Los Angeles. Those stories, many others, ahead next week on Greater LA. I hope you'll join us. But you can hear us anytime in the meantime online at kcrw.com/GLA or grab the podcast. Never miss an episode. Wherever you get your podcasts, and while you're at the website, share your thoughts with us. Even give us some story ideas. What do you want to hear on Greater LA at kcrw.com/GLA? Jenna Cagle, Juliana Mayo, Andrea Bautista, Becca Ludman, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon.
Holly Adams, Amy Ta, and Christian Bordahl all made this evening's show happen. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears and time. Have a great night.